activity. We are today covering Esther and giving some introduction to the book of Job. Okay, but Esther is the main book of the day. Job will be given kind of a highlight, and then next week is Job, and then Psalm. And so when we, well, let's start with a prayer, and then we'll go into the book. Lord our God, we are thankful for the example of persons like Esther and even of Job. We pray that as we live out our lives and face our moments of testing and crisis, that their faith might strengthen us. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, when you're doing the books of the Bible, and I assume Gary had you recite them, and he got you through Ezra and Nehemiah, and you are now back in Jerusalem, and you built the temple, and you built the wall around the city, and you marched around the wall, and you had everybody partitioned off, and the Samaritans were terrible people. You learned all that. Now we, with Esther, are going to end Old Testament history. And before I have you recite the books of the Bible, I want to put a little perspective on stuff. We are dealing with King Xerxes, or Xerox, as he's now known. And he was around, according to the Bible, 485 to 465 B.C. After that, you don't have anything in the Old Testament by way of history. You've got a long gap. And out of from that gap, eventually Jesus will be born. And what we are going to do after today is get into that five-book interlude.
There is a good fellow up here.
The five-book interlude is Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and then the question is what to call the next book. When I was a kid growing up, we called it Song of Solomon. Now, many people call it Song of Songs. And since I haven't had a creative thought since I was a kid, I'm going to call it Song of Solomon. Okay? And so what I'd like you to try to do today is say the book you know, which should be through Esther, and then try, because I know some of you have been going for extra credit the last couple of weeks by sneaking Job in there. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Okay? Now, having given you that background, let's go for it. All right? Genesis. To give some perspective as to where we are, last week when you had Ezra and Nehemiah bring the people back from captivity, we had indicated prior to the captivity time that there were some who got themselves into Babylon and kind of liked it, and we stayed. And so you had your remnant that came back to rebuild Jerusalem. But many of the Jewish people stayed in Babylon and had their own subculture there. And the book of Esther is about the group of people who stayed back and some of the events that happened. The crucial moment in this is where Mordecai is going to come to Esther when she's facing a very difficult challenge. And I suppose if you remember nothing else from the book, he tells her, in some of the older translations in which he taught, perhaps you were born for a time such as this. And I suspect that many of us who have heard the story of Esther and who know of that passage have faced moments where life has called on us to face unusual moral challenges and prophetic challenges where we've got to step forward and indicate that this is wrong, or indicate that God is calling us to do this, and to do so at great risk, to face various things when we were in Pittsburgh, when the steel workers were coming to disrupt our worship services. The Esther text was one of the ones that came to my mind as I had to face this crisis of what to do with a bunch of disgruntled labor leaders coming down to the front of the sanctuary to take over the church. And that's another story which we can maybe go into some other time. But from Esther, that is the powerful passage, and we will get to it in our study. There are those who think that the book was kind of a humorous story, that Jews for centuries would see this as just a great story to put down the anti-Semitic forces that tried to persecute and execute the Jews. Feminists kind of see it as a great turning of tables, and so it would be a story, when read, that would really be inspiring and get kind of an aha and a ha-ha out of the people who are listening to it. Here are the people who are building gallows to execute Jewish leaders who die on their own gallows. Here is a situation where an edict comes out that the Jews are going to be attacked, and then the Jews are given the right to fight back, and they beat up on everybody. And it's kind of a turning of the tables, which humor often is. And so this is an inspirational book. It's a somewhat humorous book. I imagine when you read it, you might think, well, this is funny. But if you are living under persecution, a story such as this really is an exciting, challenging, laughing at your enemies. And this morning I had gotten up early, and I was going to get here at about 8 o'clock. And then, I wound up dilly-dallying a little bit, and then Bill Cosby comes on. He's been interviewed by Dan Rabbit. Don't know if you saw it, but Cosby says that what we need now is to laugh. And sometimes when you are in the midst of an awful grief situation, as he is, having just buried his son, he says, what the family needs, what I need, and what the country needs is to laugh. And so sometimes when you're in persecution, something such as, anyway, I got that, and then I got that thing in the other channel on the Super Bowl commercial that blew away my morning. So I try to watch Charlie Gibson, but then I flip into channel surfing, I found Cosby, so then, you know, I found it. Let's get into that. The Through the Bible Notebook on page 59 gives us some stuff that's very helpful. We have studied the fact that Ezra and Nehemiah deal with the remnant which returned to Jerusalem from and Judah. And now we see that the book of Esther has to do with those who stayed in the land of captivity. Down below, the book of Esther teaches the providence of God. Providence means pro, before, video, I see. God saw beforehand what the people would do. And even though they were out of the will of God by not going back to their homeland, they were not beyond his care. Providence, then, is God providing, directing, leading people who sometimes do not want to be led. Interesting, in a couple books that we're going to study, Song of Solomon is one of them. It's almost an X-rated book. Here in Esther, the name of God is never mentioned. It is a secular story of an ethnic people under persecution. But even in this secular story, one of the great feasts of the Jewish tradition, the Feast of Purim, comes to the fore. Let's take a look at the book and walk our way through the story. Chapter 1, Xerxes is having a party. Now, when we have a Super Bowl party, it may, for those who are really into the beer and the chips, it may start around 3 and end when either people pass out or the game is over, and usually everybody's home by 11. Xerxes throws a party, and the thing goes for at least a week. And you can just imagine what a raunchy situation this was. An all-male gathering. His wife, Vashti, very attractive woman, is having the women of Dillery over to her place for a party, Lady Fingers, while the kegs are over with the guys. The guys get themselves completely inebriated, and Xerxes decides it's time to bring in the little woman so the guys can kind of ogle at her. This is the seventh day. The boys have been drinking now for a week. All right. He calls Vashti, and Vashti, not surprisingly, says, "I don't think so. I'm not going over there. This can only be a bad scene." Well, in those days, in a highly sexist society, in a totally sexist society, that doesn't go over very well. A woman has stood up to her man. The wife of the king has stood up to the king. This, as the boys are kind of staggering around, is a major crisis. And so the boys come up with a couple edicts. One, out of great concern, that if indeed Xerxes' wife stands up to him, then wives all over the kingdom might get this misguided notion that they've got minds of their own. We can't have that. And so there are various rules that are passed, that the queen Vashti now is no longer ever allowed to come into the presence of the king. She is being dispatched, and she will be replaced. We're going to get a better woman, it says over here in verse 19. Your Majesty, issue a royal proclamation that Vashti may never again appear before the king. Have it written into the laws of the Medes, the Persians and Media, the Medes and the Persians, so that it can never be changed. Then give her place as queen to a better woman. Well, they then decide that what they will do is have a contest among the virgins of the territory to see which of them is the one that will win the king's favor. There are eunuchs all over the place here, and one of the eunuchs is the fellow who is in charge of the beautification program. These young ladies have a year. If you think the goings on in Atlantic City of the Miss America pageant are bizarre, and they are, this is even more so. You've got massages, you've got mud baths, you've got a special diet. They work on you for a year, so that what the king's doing during this year is not mentioned. But one of the persons who might be a candidate is this young gal, Esther, who is related to Mordecai, both of them Jews. He has essentially become her father. I think he's an uncle, isn't he, or a cousin or something like that, a cousin. And Mordecai gets her entered in the contest. It's not known that she's Jewish or that Mordecai is. And the fella Haggai, the eunuch, kind of takes a shine to her. And so he works on her maybe a little bit better than on some of the others. And over in chapter 2, verse 17, when her time to kind of strut before the king came, the king liked her more than any of the other girls, and more than any of the others, she won his favor and affection. Down in 20, she had still not let it be known that she was Jewish. And at about this time, Mordecai discovers that a couple of the people who are working for the king are plotting to do him in. He gets the word to the king's court, and they do their investigation. It is discovered that these people were indeed going to kill the king. The king realizes Mordecai has saved his life, has this written down in the journals of the kingdom, and for permanent record, and this will come back later. Now you come to a fellow named Haman, who has been named prime minister, and he does something which puts a challenge before the people. Daniel's going to have a similar kind of a situation when we get there, where the secular society in which you live gives you certain laws which, if you stop to think about it, challenge your faith. The whole question of who is the Lord of your life is something that we in America try to avoid facing, and the way in which we avoid facing it is by saying that since the government has given us, quote, freedom of religion, which I'm not sure as much freedom of religion as you might think it is, but the government has given us certainly more freedom of religion than you had in the Soviet Union, or you had when you had to worship God in the catacombs. Since we have given you freedom of religion, you owe us. And because you owe us, don't ever raise any questions that would cause anyone ever to have to differentiate between the Christian faith and patriotism. And so in America, we are raised never dealing with some of the fundamental issues of the faith, which is God the God of your life? You are almost raised in America with the fact you've got several gods. One is the one you worship at church. Another is the one you learn about at school. Another is the one you serve in the armed forces, etc. And as a consequence, a country that I believe almost bribes you with the freedom of religion thing, which is a wonderful thing constitutionally if the church stays tough, causes us to become weak, causes us to become lax. There is a fervency that you see to Christians in oppressive nations that you don't see in this nation, and we've known that from the get-go, can't get a handle on it, but it's interesting to read stuff like this in Esther. It'll come up again at the end of the Bible, in Revelation, comes up in Daniel, comes up again and again in the Old Testament prophets. Do you obey God, or do you obey the secular powers? In the time of the revolution, or of Revelation, you were to say, Caesar is Lord. That's good. You pledge allegiance to Caesar. If you couldn't pledge allegiance to Caesar, there's something wrong with you. Christians said, we can't do that. We're not going to pledge allegiance to Caesar. We are devoted to the one God, and they were willing to die rather than say Caesar is Lord. Here, you've got this fellow Haman who wants everybody to bow and scrape. You owe your allegiance to your government. You owe your allegiance to your country. You owe your allegiance to the leaders, and you will bow before us. Mordecai says, I can't do that. I will be a good citizen. I will honor the country. I will serve the country. But don't ask me to do for the country what I can only do for God. I only bow my knee before God. Well, it's like Haman absolutely living. You're supposed to pay all kinds of lip service. You're supposed to say all kinds of things, etc. Life is too short. Haman is really upset with Mordecai. And because he is upset with one member of the Jewish community, he goes beyond that to the seeds of anti-Semitism. I see that one, I don't like the one, therefore I will hate all of them. And so this is where racism comes from, it's where sexism comes from, it's where all kinds of anti-Semitism and so forth. Let me see if I can figure out where we are at this point. He decides that it's time just to get rid of these people. They are a problem, they are a nuisance, they are not obeying my wishes, they are a thorn in my flesh. We will exterminate of the Jewish people. And that word goes out. And he, if the king isn't paying too much attention, and hey, you know, anybody who sits in an executive position, you have people throwing paper in front of you all of the time, and you hope that they have read it and that what it is a good thing, or they will so phrase the thing when they bring it in that it sounds innocuous, whereas it really isn't. And I guess the king says this is okay, and so the word goes out by camel and donkey and whatever else to all of the provinces that on a certain day all the Jews are going to be killed. Well, this causes turmoil, and needless to say, does not go over well with Mordecai, who goes to Esther for help. Esther's problem is that though she is the queen, she has not been called by the king into the chambers for a month. And you don't just walk into the Oval Office. And so you, if you do, and you haven't been invited, and it ruffles the feathers of the king, you will be executed. And so Esther realizes, if I go in to plead the case for the people, and the king is not happy that I've gone in for an unscheduled visit, he will kill me, but if he holds up this whatever scepter or whatever, then it's okay. Well, she kind of stands there at the door, you know, and he says, oh, you know, oh, yeah. And he holds this thing up, and in she comes and begins to chat. And what she does is invite the king and Haman to a banquet. And they have the banquet, and in the next 24 hours are going to be quite remarkable. Haman is now going to plot to kill Mordecai. He is going to build a gallows 75 feet high. And then the king does what many bureaucrats do. He thumbing through some of the old records the next morning, and he sees this guy Mordecai saved my life. Did we ever do anything for him? Didn't we give him a trophy or a banquet sometime? So what did we do for him? I mean, people go scurrying around. I don't know that we ever did anything. We've got to honor this guy. So you can imagine in an executive office how this kind of thing, oh, my goodness, we were supposed to thank this guy, this is terrible, let's figure out a way to take care of it. He calls in Haman, he says, hey, I got a guy I've got to honor. Haman thinks it's himself, and tells all these fancy things you've got to do, and then announces that it is Mordecai. Just to make a short story long here, Esther eventually indicates that Haman has been plotting to get Mordecai, and Haman has been doing these terrible things. He's going to kill this great hero on the gallows. Xerxes, perhaps a couple fours lights into the evening, decided, I have him hung on those gallows. And so Haman is hung on the gallows that he had built to kill Mordecai, which is a great turning of the tables. And as I say, when the people heard this story, they would think it was fantastic. Now, the line I blew past very quickly was when Mordecai is saying to Esther in the first place, I want you to risk your life by going in to talk to the king, his argument was this. It's in 4:12. When Mordecai received Esther's message, he sent her a warning. Don't imagine that you are safer than any other Jew just because you are in the royal palace. If you keep quiet at a time like this, help will come from heaven to the Jews, and they will be saved. But you will die, and your father's family will come to an end. Yet who knows? Maybe it was for a time like this that you were made queen. That's the modern translation I've got here. The older translation, it was a time like this for which you were born. And that's the powerful passage. What happens here is that after Haman has been killed, they've got a problem in that there is a royal edict that says on the something or other, it's the 13th day of Abur or something like that, all the Jews are to be attacked. You can't undo a royal edict. And so the counter edict goes back, which is probably what should have been the American foreign policy in Bosnia 4 years ago. Let the other team fight. It was a situation, we can't stop the attack, or the people are permitted to attack the Jews, but we're going to make sure the Jews are able to fight back. Well, this prevented some of the attacks occurring in the first place, and the Jews fought back and beat the heck out of the people who were attacking them. Again, people reading this story in times of oppression would find it to be just absolutely fascinating. They'd be cheering as they read this to their children. Purim is casting a lot. Haman cast lots to determine the day on which the Jews were to be exterminated. God used that act, turned it around, empowered the Jewish people, and they fought back. What you have in the book of Esther is record of the fact that God, you know, and you understand it's in a highly sexist culture, God works through women. God works his purpose out in any land at any time. And God can turn bad things around and make them good. Esther is a great example of how God works through human beings in difficult situations. Esther, a Jew, married a Gentile. Ruth, a Gentile, married a Jew. And both of them play a significant role in Old Testament history. I don't know that I need to go into much more of Esther. Nice little book. The people who stayed behind when Ezra and Nehemiah went back into Jerusalem and into Judea. Now, we come to the end of history of the Old Testament. It may be that at some point prior to the New Testament, and remind me to do this, we ought to take a class just on what isn't in the Protestant Bible of the stuff that goes on between the Old Testament and the New. Because there was quite a bit of history that is there. And so remind me of that. We're months away from Matthew. So before we do that, I have a tendency to come up with these great ideas and then forget them. So I'm counting on you to be my reminders of that. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of something or other. Interesting books. I hope you have been reading Psalms a little bit at a time. If you haven't been, I don't recommend you read that whole book in a week. And I don't recommend that you read it out of the new translations. I would recommend the newest translation to use for Psalms is the New Revised Standard Version. If you read it in the Good News, you'll be disappointed. Still, you can read it, the Good News, if you want to. But reading it in the New Revised Standard is I find, very, very helpful. Old King James, if you can handle that. But when I go through it, I go through it in the New Revised Standard. Read, we're going to do Job next week. We're going to intro it here today. We're going to do Job next week, Psalms the week after. And if you don't get through Psalms, don't worry about it. Keep reading a psalm a day, keep the devil away, and eventually you will get through the book of Psalms. But that is not a book where I'd necessarily recommend you knock the whole thing off in a week. That's a little heavy. Job is a fascinating book. Some of you I know are already into it. It is a book that has a two-chapter prologue, which gives a very fanciful encounter in heaven that sets the stage, and then it has an extended poem of dialogue where Job's friends try to come in to help him. And one of the most pathetic demonstrations of religion that I ever see is when religious people try to minister to people who are in trouble and try, A, to explain the situation, and B, to say something that's going to make it all right. And two rules you need to understand going in to help somebody whose life is falling apart is you can't explain it. There is no explanation. And further, there is nothing you can say that is going to make everything all right. There's some stuff you can say to be with the person through the doo-doo, but you can't get rid of the doo-doo. All right? Doo-doo happens. And you got to face it. And so you have got in the book of Job a fascinating study of human suffering and a very frustrating study of human suffering. Harold Kushner's young son died of an illness. The rabbi could not understand, why did this happen to me? And why did it happen to him? Why is this suffering? And he realizes you can't ask the why question. And so he publishes a book that many persons just instinctively think is called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, but that's not the title of the book. It's When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It misses a lot. There's a lot lacking in it. But one thing that the book does is maintain a fairly faithful extension of Job, which is to indicate you cannot find a one-to-one correlation between being a virtuous, obedient, good person and having good things happen to you. Life doesn't work that way, and we don't know why. So if nothing else, the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and you've got to take on the title, who on earth is a good person? We've all got our good parts and our bad parts. And so you just got that question of goodness and badness, and you've got to deal with it as best you can. Also, there's the question of, do you absolutely know what's a bad thing? Many things that happen that you think are difficult and challenging and bad, maybe aren't that bad. Anyway, Job is a very fascinating book, and what I want to give you here today is just a little bit of the overview by way of background of the first two chapters and the philosophy. The philosophy I want to run through again and again and again. In the Through the Bible Notebook, page 63, it talks about these five books, give something of an explanation. And down here in about line 10 of section 2, we are to see that when affliction comes, God has a reason. That's kind of that's crucial. And then down here, and then the central message is, why do the godly suffer? I'm not sure either of those sentences are accurate. Let me have a little dialogue with those sentences, and then I'll walk you through the first two chapters. We are to see that when affliction comes, God has a reason, a better understanding of the book. And if you think God has a reason, that gives you the notion that if you can really get in touch with God, you'll have an explanation. A better way to state it is that life is a series of peaks and valleys and long plateaus, and whether you're in a peak or in a valley or in a long plateau, God is God. And once you start talking about reasons, then you begin to think there must be a why that I can deal with. Because it is better to think God is God rather than to think God has a reason, your response to suffering is never to be why, but always what now. The Mothers Against Drunk Driving, started by a mother whose child was killed by a drunk driver. She did not labor over the issue, why did this happen? She began to act out her grief in a therapeutic way by saying, what now, and how can I turn this into a godly purpose? And she started this organization. So it's not a matter of why, but what now. And then they say, and down here the central message, why do the godly suffer? I think the book of Job is a testimony to the fact that why do the godly suffer is a stupid question. And because to raise the question implies we could come up with some kind of an answer. The fundamental question is not why, but who. Now we're going to go into that a little bit more next week. Let's set the stage. So if you haven't read this yet, and most of you have not, again, understand, you're gonna be reading along in normal paragraphs, and when you come to chapter 3, all of a sudden it becomes a poem. And that poem just takes off and goes right up until the conclusion. Okay? Somebody was reading it, it looks like a poem, but it doesn't rhyme. The situation that you have in the first two chapters is God assembles the heavenly court. Now, you remember back in Genesis, God says, let us make man in our image. And you may wonder, who is the us? And who is the our? They're talking. There's a thought of a heavenly council, and one of the persons sitting on the executive council in heaven is Satan, who will eventually get kicked out and decide to start his own franchise here on earth. But God and Satan are having a conversation. And God says to Satan, and they're all showing up at the meeting, it's in Florida, and they checked into the hotel. And God says to Satan, where you been? What you been up to? Satan says, I've been on earth walking around. And God says, that's impressive. Did you see my main man, Job? God begins to brag about Job, that this is an unbelievably virtuous, good man. So Satan raises a hypothetical question, you see, as to why is he so good? And the ultimate, and all kinds of, Job indeed is, he does all kinds of, they have a feast, as is here in verse 5, the morning after each feast, Job would get up early and offer sacrifices for each of his children in order to purify them. He always did this because he thought that one of them might have sinned by insulting God unintentionally. And as Job really was a super achiever in terms of being a good guy, Satan comes up with a great question. And this will preach. Right? He says, would Job worship you if he got nothing out of it? In a consumer society where people shop for churches and will participate to the extent that they are fed or get something out of it, that's an interesting question. In a society where most anything goes, you know, why be moral if there is no payoff? I mean, you look at the people who the country will put on at the halftime show of the Super Bowl, it is not testimony that virtue rises to the top. Right? This thought crosses my mind. So this is an interesting question here. Would Job worship you if he got nothing out of it? They said, well, don't know. I think he'd be good. I'd say, no, I think he'd hurt you. You take the stuff away from him, you take all the rewards you get from religion, I don't think he would, I don't think he'd do it. Well, they decided you got a little test. And God says, all right, look, let's make a little wager here. You can mess up his life, but don't hurt him. And so, catastrophic things happen. I mean, just horrendous, hellacious things happen. Cattle kind of beamed up by spaceships or whatever. Children killed. That's awful. He's lost it all. And his response is, the Lord gave, and now the Lord takes away. May his name be praised. That's a far cry from what my father used to say to the Atheist Club at McKinnon College, used to sing, blame God from whom all blunders blow. was their doxology. And so rather than the blame God from whom all blunders blow, you've got this Job, and you ought to underline this in your Bible, chapter 1, verse 21, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. May his name be praised. Well, Satan feels he lost round 1, but he says, how about double or nothing? How about if I'm able to hurt the guy? And but don't kill him, because when you kill him, he's kind of all bets are off, because he can't figure out how he's going to respond one way or the other. And so God says, all right, he's yours, work him over, but don't kill him. And so this is going on, and he gets all sorts of difficulties, and his wife comes to him, and men don't suffer particularly well. Women, you know, in the 90s, both my wife had some surgery in Pittsburgh, and basically we weren't sure it was going to survive. And so, and then she had all kinds of problems. But, you know, she comes to, she handles this thing with great flash. Handled her time of trouble far better than I handle mine. And so guys don't handle these things well. We do complete control extremely well. Begin to have some things wobble a bit, and we just aren't to that good. Job's wife, au contraire, is not necessarily Mother Teresa. All right? Job's wife comes there, and evidently Job may, but evidently around the house Job was kind of down, heavy sores, and maybe it drove her nuts, you know? He's got these poor secrets got out of here, I guess somebody better. His wife says to him in 2:9, are you still as faithful as ever? Yeah, listen, you are still as faithful as ever, aren't you? Why don't you curse God and die? That's the loving little woman, you know? Why don't you curse God and die? And Job says, you're talking nonsense. When God sends us something good, we welcome it. How can we complain when he sends us trouble? The patience of Job and the virtue of Job really is highlighted here in these first two chapters. The full humanity of Job and his own anguish will become clearer as he's dealing with his friends in the rest of the book. The friends are going to come to him basically to say to Job, everything makes sense. There's an explanation for this. You are suffering for a reason. And when people take that tack with somebody who is suffering, they are not taking it for the benefit of the person suffering. They are saying it for their own benefit, which is that you are suffering and there is a reason for it. We've got to figure out what it is. And because life is ultimately rational, if I can avoid doing what you did, I'm not going to suffer. And so most persons who go to minister to the hurting go ultimately to minister to themselves. Next week we are going to go through those dialogues in the poetic situation where they are trying to explain it to Job and they frustrate the heck out of him. He gets mad at them. They're going to argue about it. And through it all, we're going to learn quite a bit about how to minister to each other and learn quite a bit about how ambiguous this earthly journey is. We will see you next week.